Welcome to the game.
It's a beautiful thing.
With Mark Duffield.
By golly gosh.
The son of a darkened shearer and a self-described ball-playing jack-of-all-trades.
We shouldn't be surprised, should we?
Who lit up footy fields in the southwest before becoming WA's preeminent AFL scribe.
My goodness.
And Glenn Quarterman.
Wow-wee.
A proud Victorian parked permanently in the west who would have played 300 AFL games if not for his incredibly small hands.
Goodness gracious me.
Together, they are Duff and Quarters.
You know who.
And this is your favourite footy podcast.
It's unbelievable.
Hello, everybody. It's the Tuesday after the grand final has been played and run and won. This is the Duff and Quarters podcast. We are brought to you by Tab Touch. You can get closer to the AFL action with Tab Touch. Please gamble responsibly. Please call Gambler's Help on 1800 858 858 if you run into any difficulties. Okay, in the studio, we have Josh Garlop, our producer and sound effects man extraordinaire. We have Mark Golden Tonsils Reddings. We have Glenn Smallhands Quartermain. I am Mark, the son of a darkened shearer, Duffield. And guys, what a weekend. What a way for Melbourne to break the drought. And what a great day for West Australia.
Wasn't it? Collective sigh of relief. I think we all breathed at the end of it. But what a magnificent show. Well done, Western Australia. I felt really proud on the day and on the night, I should say. The sound was unbelievable. The stadium was heaving. Everyone I spoke to back in the East Coast were envious and saying what a great job you did as custodian. So well done, everyone. And the game, as bizarre as it was, I think was just captivating. Given where we're at 19 minutes into the third quarter.
Yeah, the game itself, you look back in history and think, what a 70-plus point result to Melbourne, and it won't show how many twists and turns and how quickly the game changed. I don't think I've seen a game of footy change as quickly as that, particularly in a big game. So it had all the elements. There was a bit of drama. There was the crowd, and even standing out for – I've commentated a couple of quarters in the – with the general public, it was just a great buzz. And sometimes you don't get that at the MCG, given the corporate nature of Grand Final Day in Melbourne. But it felt like it was just a celebration of what this ground is, what this state has with its love affair with football. So it was a fantastic result. And I feel the best storyline came to pass.
It did. There were two aspects, even of the turnaround, weren't there? There was the first four goals that put them in front, and then those three goals in 40 seconds. Are we ever going to see three goals in 40 seconds in a game again, in any game, let alone a grand final?
Yeah, well, look, we will, but I think...
Have you ever seen it before?
Oh, no, but, well, yeah, I have, I suspect, in a very one-sided game in the middle of the year that really is meaningless.
Do you reckon can you ever remember seeing it before?
No, I'm with you, Duff. I don't know if we'll see it in a grand final. Can't recall it. I was actually commentating and handing over at three-quarter time. I got up with 15 seconds to go to basically let Adam Papalia finish off the quarter. Another goal was he had to come back into the seat to finish off the turn because it just doesn't happen that quickly. I'll ask you the question. 19 points in front, Bulldogs leading. We're all going, okay, the Bont's probably got the Norm Smith medal in his back pocket at the moment. It's not signed, sealed and delivered. And as soon as we thought that, I think we all felt
they were one goal away.
It felt like one goal away from breaking them.
Yeah, and I thought it was Bont or Daniel. I thought Daniel had done a terrific job too. They just looked shot to bits. I looked at Gawn at a ruck contest in the forward pocket and I just thought, you look shot to bits. But obviously after that, Jackson went into the middle and the game changed a bit. That was a significant move, I thought. But the energy that just built around them, it's just an extraordinary resurrection.
But you also look at what Melbourne have done during the season, and the most glaring example is against Geelong, where they're down by 44 points in that last home and away match. And those types of moments, whether subconsciously or whether it was mentioned, they found a way this year through adversity, through being – yeah. And you have to beat good sides over four quarters. Richmond has shown that over the past 5 or 6 years. You cannot leave the door open. And I think it's fair to say Melbourne at the moment is very much akin to what we saw for Richmond. Just you cannot allow them the chance to get back in the game, because it was a tsunami of footy.
And, you know, I'll just say one thing. I felt sorry for the Bulldogs in that at that 19-minute mark of the third quarter, I thought, what an extraordinary performance by you to get yourself into this position. You've broken Melbourne's back. Given all the travel, give everything we've talked about in the lead-up, I thought it was an extraordinary performance. It's a little disappointing history. You look at the record books and you'll go, they were smashed. But really, they fell one quarter and a bit short of a really, really good season.
I'm not sure it is disappointing. You know, I think that for everything that Melbourne's gone through and the way they've conducted themselves in the lead up to that, it was kind of like their fate and destiny that once the dam wall broke, there would be this tsunami. And that was what the last quarter and a bit was. It was a tsunami event. They came out the front of stoppage. Petrarca was unbelievable. Fritsch was unbelievable. Luke Jackson was exceptional. Angus Brayshaw was exceptional. Viney was exceptional. Oliver was exceptional. You can just keep going and going and going. I mean, Christian Salem's first quarter was as clean as a whistle when everyone else was panicky and fumbly. And he topped it off with the goal late. It was the sort of event that happens when just a team that has not believed and has not succeeded and has had, you know, a litany of failures and a litany of setbacks, and in Melbourne's case, a litany of tragedies as well. Basically, they just clear the fence and it's just greenfield in front of them.
Isn't it amazing when you know the back is broken and you've won, and it is, as you call that, tsunami of goals, just the look in supporters' eyes
early in the
last
quarter. You can
sense the players out there realize, oh, we're home here, we're home, and the party starts. It's just great to watch.
And let's be honest, I mean, Melbourne had a good run with injuries this year, I think. I mean, they didn't have long-term injuries to their key players. Stephen May, by the way, revealing he had a 6-centimetre tear in his
hand. Because footy clubs never lie.
No, but the list
doesn't. He looked all right, moved all right.
But the list availability doesn't lie either. They had a good list, and you need a bit of luck, and the Bulldogs had it tougher during the finals, and hence I think we all picked Melbourne. I thought they'd win by six goals and break away, but I was halfway short of what I should have been. So the other thing that I think is worth pointing out is they handled their celebrations thus far, touch wood. I walked past my local in Mount Lawley yesterday, taking the dog for a walk, and I got pulled in to have a quick drink with someone, and the whole Melbourne squad was there, sitting at a table.
At the Inglewood?
No, it was at the Elford Hotel.
Oh, yeah.
And they were sitting there, and obviously they were fatigued, but they were taking – my daughter got a photo with Max Gorn. They've handled this win, this celebration, with grace and humility, and I think they've done themselves an absolute service with the way they've carried on the last two or three days, because other teams haven't in the past.
And what about the footage of them at that nightclub on Saturday night?
Marketplace?
Market
and they're still in their shorts and socks and boots.
You know who it reminded me of? Steve Waugh.
Yes, true. Good call.
And apparently they still had strapping on. Like they just gone, right.
Yeah, I'm not.
We're not interrupting this for showers and getting cleaned up. We're going straight into it.
So it begs the question. They'll be outright premiership favourites if you look at the market today, which I haven't. And, of course, the D word gets mentioned straight away.
Oh, dynasty.
Dynasty. Now, it's used very flippantly. It's used very regularly. Their age profile looks okay. So in the sense of what they can do going forward, there should be some sustained success. Plus, doesn't always pan out that way.
No, it doesn't. But also the growth of players such as Luke Jackson. So he's got growth in him, and that was a pretty fair grand final, to be honest. But there's a lot of players with that. So provided they, you know, when they get through this period of celebration and they – I like the words of Goodwin after the game too, in terms of a lot of respect about the game and what we've done here, and we will respect the start of pre-season when we get back to it. I like those words.
He also said, though, this is not the end of anything.
Yes.
This is the start of something. This is where we want to be. I tend to think that – Skeet, you're right. There are no guarantees, but I tend to think if they don't win at least one more, they've come up short.
Yep.
This is the competition's best list now, and when you look at it, it's a list that's going to get better. Three of the competition's best midfielders, three of the competition's best defenders, and when you look in front of the ball, You've got Luke Jackson, who's going to, you know, do more ruck work, but he's also going to play forward. He's going to get better. Cozzy Pickett's going to get better. You know, even the smaller forwards, Brayley Fritch is not old. He's going to get better. So their one area that we questioned them on, which is their attack. Their attack is going to improve. It's not going to diminish.
Let me throw a hypothetical. I was talking with a couple of people in the last quarter. Petrarca was always going to be the Norm Smith medalist, finished with 39, not 40, which is neither here nor there, but that was the official figure. Simon Black, we talked about him last week with 39 touches in 203. So the record doesn't belong to Petrarca. What if Bailey Fritch had kicked 8, for instance? Is it an argument?
He needed 10.
Okay, so did he have to kick double figures?
Or he needed 10, yep.
Yeah,
which is and I think that tells you how good Petrarca was, because no player has kicked 6 goals in a grand final for, I think
Jarman kicked a handful.
So Darren Jarman,
I think 5 in the last quarter. I think
was that 97 or 98
against the Saints?
97. He also kicked 6. He kicked 6 in one and 5 in the other. You know, he kicked bags in both grand finals.
So when you go back that far, that puts Fritch's performance in context, and yet he wasn't even close.
No, I think it was Petrarca and then Daylight at the end, really.
But Fritch got 2 votes from most of the North Smith medal judges, yeah.
Yeah, he got, and also with the coaches' votes, he got the 10 votes. So I think it was, we all thought that. But with the Western Bulldogs, I think there's a bit of growth there too. Don't forget, they've got Jamari Ugelhagen in the wings. They've got Tim English will improve further. They've got, they'll pick up Darcy in the draft. So there's a bit going on at the Bulldogs too. I wouldn't write them off. I think they'll be top 4 again next year and we'll have another role at it.
Okay, so we know that the Bulldogs' strength is their midfield. How does that happen to a midfield as good as theirs? Did they get tired?
I reckon they got tired, and I reckon it was more about Melbourne than it was the Dogs, though. It was just incredible momentum. Both of you mentioned a tsunami. It's pretty hard to stop that, given where they'd been. I think the tide just turned for them, and there's not much they could do about it, to be honest.
That being said, second quarter, Bontempelli, Treloar hit the scoreboard, and I asked the question at quarter time, where are they getting their goals from? That's how they did. I think over the course of the 4 quarters, though, Melbourne's bigger-bodied midfielders, they just out-muscled them. And that was, for me, just so staggering that a team as good as the Bulldogs in their midfield were unable to go with them.
Once he gets front of stoppage and with those hips, you're just not going to stop Petrarca. He's very hard to stop. I'll tell you what, a few Collingwood supporters were out there hoping Dogs didn't win, because that was a great contribution to the Western Bulldogs.
He was good, Treloar, wasn't he?
Was.
Yep,
he was.
He was very good.
He's had two grand finals where it's... he's been on the wrong end of it, and that can happen in a player's career, can't it? I mean, we've seen Nathan Buckley, so many very good players, not putting Treloar in the same bracket as some of the superstars, but you can sometimes be like Ben Brown on the right side of a trade or a change of clubs, and sometimes at this point, Treloar's still waiting.
Bontempelli's second quarter was something to behold, really.
Yes.
You know, the 9 touches, pushing forward, kicking the 2 goals, both off pack marks. Interestingly, he kicks the 3rd in the 3rd quarter. The Johannesson screamer on the goal line. If Johannesson doesn't mark that, Bontempelli does.
He
at that stage, he was feeling it, and he was going to take that game under his arm and march off with it. So that was a great effort. Obviously, pretty much gassed later on, I think. The Dogs, look, they're going to be there or thereabouts, but I tell you what, there's a lot of ground to make up on Melbourne here, I think.
It can
change quickly.
Yeah, and I think just for this one game, you're right, destiny is a good word. It just felt like that. I don't think they'll get it on those terms again. I really don't. But, hey, they got it on those terms on Saturday night, and well done to them.
That being said, if they get back, the MCG is where the next grand final is going to be. It's a long way away. But, yeah, I'm a little bit in your quarters here where everything's romantic about how good Melbourne is and how good they'll continue to be. But you think of clubs that have broken droughts, and look, Richmond did it against Adelaide, and they obviously had that really good run. But the next year is always difficult. Winning back-to-back is just so tough, and the West Coast Eagles, as good as they were in 92, couldn't do it in 93. And whatever excuse you bring up, they're very tough to get in. Go back to Hawthorn, 88, 89. That was the first time they'd won back-to-back flags. So all of those great clubs, it was hard. And we talk of dynasties with Hawthorn, Brisbane, Geelong to some extent, and Richmond, all in that bracket. Back-to-back's not easy.
I don't think I'm not talking back-to-back, though. I think that for the next 4 years, we're going to see Melbourne in the top 4.
No question.
I think we're going to see them in preliminary finals.
I'll be stunned if they're not in the top 4 the next at least 3 years.
All right. The grand final in Perth, did we nail it?
Yep.
No question. Look, and Quarter summed it up. I was standing there with my family. I was so proud of you can't control the weather, but gee,
now let me
Mother Nature helped us out big time.
Now, let me tell you something. The brief chat, very, very brief chat late with Gil McLaughlin up in the Victory Lounge. I think I was talking gibberish at that stage, but I apologize, Gil. But, no, Gil, but what happened,
Gil? He's Gil, I think.
So what happened? We're just standing there and it started raining.
Yes, exactly.
And
right.
Gil McLaughlin's just gone, oh, it's raining. Unbelievable. And I thought to myself, Ali, George Foreman, in Zaire,
the rumble
1973,
in the
it rained for 3 days, about 2 minutes after they left the boxing ring. And it was at about 3 a.m. in the morning that fight was staged. So it had elements of that to it. And well done. Like, just the gods, the weather gods just said, okay, everyone's off. Okay, I'll dump now.
And the public- so was there a bit of rope-a-dope about the way the Demons went about it? They just let the doggies punch themselves out.
Possibly. I'll tell you what, though. You mentioned Gil McLaughlin, and have to say, Travis Old, don't know him that well, but every time I met him, he's a delightful bloke to talk with. And you could see Chris Gil McLaughlin sitting down in that Victory Lounge afterwards, and of course publicly very buoyant and bubbly, but he looked as if, wow, I'm so relieved we've got to the finish line, because it has been a heck of a journey to get to this point. And bear in mind the time they had to organise a WA Grand Final. I know it's nothing huge, but the entertainment, I think, for what they had was really good. So look,
and the activation outside the ground, I'm told, was first class. So look, I think everyone deserves a pat on the back. I think it also shows us what we can do. So this is not the end, only the start for Perth.
But I don't think we'll be able to put the argument about another grand final here for a while because of what Victoria has gone through and is going through. I think we just have to let the dust settle, as tempting as it is.
But at the very least, we now have this is what we did.
Exactly. So, and I think at the very least too, and let's assume that Victoria can host this grand final next year and it's back at the MCG, they need to learn a few things, I think. It's all very well to be tied to traditions, but there are certain things that happened at this game that I think the MCG can take some learnings out of. And one of those things is the pre-match entertainment at the MCG. Forget what the entertainment is. The crowd's wandering in like Brown's cows for an afternoon game. Mm-hmm. You know, they're filtering into the game. They're not paying attention. We've had the Black Eyed Peas there. We've had other big international acts performing at the MCG. No one's paying any attention. And then everyone pots it afterwards. Oh, it was underwhelming, you know, blah, blah, blah. They got everyone in their seats on Saturday. Mm. They got them looking at the entertainment. It was West Australian entertainment, so they were proud of it. They wanted to pay attention to it. They cheered for it. They were involved in it. The atmosphere in the stadium built off the back of it. I think a twilight grand final is the right time.
Agree.
I think we've seen if they crawl back to a 2:30 time slot, they're crawling back like a dog to its vomit.
So, and you were part of the pre-match entertainment, Skeet. The traditional event in Melbourne is North Melbourne Grand Final breakfast. You were part of the North Melbourne Grand Final lunch.
Yeah.
So it worked.
It changes the time slot. I must admit, I was a bit concerned at the lunch watching people at 12:30 and how they're going to be, how fresh they would be at 5 o'clock. But look, the behaviour, I think, from what I saw was pretty good at the ground. But I agree with you, Toto. I think if we look ahead, 4:30 Melbourne time or thereabouts, 5 o'clock even, we talk about families and kids. I don't think 8 o'clock's an impost for getting kids out and home at that time on a grand final night. So I think we have to, I know the broadcasters, Seven, want to continue with that because the ratings were amazing. So much to like. Mind you, the MCG doesn't have the same lighting capacity as what we do here. So that's one element. But you're right. All those other factors.
Upgrade it.
Not sure how easy that is. You might be right. Might be a simple.
It's expensive, but it's not difficult to do.
I just think there are some learnings to take out of it. And I think some of the things, the MCG is a great venue. It's a traditional venue for the grand final. But some of the things, and every year you have this, you know, the AFL goes out of its way to put on a show. The show gets ignored and then it gets potted afterwards because everyone ignored it.
Mm.
So let's try and get some a format together where everyone gets in there, they're all ready to watch something, they watch it, they appreciate it, they cheer for it, and we get everyone in the right mood for the start of the game. All right, boys, let's move on. A couple of things from around the league. So Jared Cameron delisted today by West Coast Quarters.
Yes, well, I'm told his manager has said it's not over the line, but it's more than likely he'll play a year in the Waffle next year.
Yeah.
I don't think there was a talk he may move to Queensland, but apparently that's not happening now. So sounds like he needs a year to take a breath and perhaps recapture his confidence.
I think it's more than just his body. I think there's a – having spoken to someone at the Eagles, there's –
He needs to decide how badly he wants
whether footy is for him. And yep. That is a question I'm sure lots of players go through when they're on the fringe or there's injuries involved. So it's not an unusual situation. He's a real talent, but there's a difference between having that talent and being able to commit yourself, body and mind, to what you need to do to be a full-time footballer.
Okay. Jared Brander being thrown up as a possibility as part of the trade. Sam Petrescu-Seaton, obviously from Carlton, nominating West Coast as his club of choice, wants to come home. Do we see a Petrescu-Seaton for Brander?
I don't see why not. They're both first-rounders. I don't see why that can't happen.
Yeah, no, that's looks on paper to be a reasonable 50-50.
Interestingly, it was Petrocelli before Brander was thrown up. So I would happily engage that as well.
And it sounds like Carlton are going to be prepared to give up that second draft pick at some stage to get Adam Scherer there. So pick six and then question
so,
mark.
So Fremantle's going to need that second draft pick because Geelong Jordan has Clark. The contract
yep.
for Jordan Clark. Jordan Clark, so Geelong says Jordan Clark is worth a late first, early second. He isn't because he's not in their best team, but they have a contract.
Yeah, so 20-something should get the job done.
So if you're Geelong, you are doing exactly what Geelong is doing.
Yeah.
And Fremantle's going to have to find a way to nurtle their way through that.
The departure of quite a few assistants at Geelong, including Matthew Scarlett. Now, just listening to people in footy, not sure that Jordan and Matty Scarlett were on the same page at times. So whether that might give the Cats something to sell to Jordan Clark is one thing, but as soon as I heard that, someone else said to me, well, he's packed his bags and he's essentially gone.
I don't think he wants to stay in Geelong. I think he wants – he'll be here.
So I think that even though like it's all very well for people at Geelong and that – I'm talking about Chris Scott to say, oh, well, Matthew Scarlett didn't want him in his back six. If the senior coach wants you playing, you're playing, whatever the line coach is saying. Mm. So I would say that there's a bit of heavily spun stuff going on there. Jordan Clark was not in consideration. Like when you think about how poorly they played in that first final in Adelaide, and they were absolutely screaming out for speed
and run. Yes,
and Jordan Clark was not even a consideration for their next final. So of all the players they're talking about coming in, you know, there was Max Holmes, there was a couple of others. They were talking about bringing Wheels in. He was not even in the frame.
Yeah.
So they've got – if they're trying to get Jordan Clark back into the fold, they've got a very hard sell. I absolutely don't blame them at all because he's got a contract saying, okay, well, you're going to have to give. And Fremantle is probably going to have to give slightly more than he's actually worth at the moment because he's not an AFL player playing AFL football
at the moment. With – say Clark comes to the Dockers, and that's another player that is returning after not getting – a lot of opportunity. Just the expectations, I think, have to be just steady because obviously if he can't get a game with a team that made a preliminary final, they're a good side, but just always a bit cautious about where
of course,
his
but
development
I've,
is at.
You've got to also look at, we've just spoken about the fact that Scarlett didn't want him in that back six. So it was very difficult for him to force his way in. So maybe he's going to have to earn his place in the Freo side. But
he'd have no guarantee of the Fremantle back six. I mean,
well, I don't think
he'll be in the back six. He'll be on the wing.
Yeah.
And we asked Justin Longmuir about this on Sports Talk on the ABC on Saturday. And Justin didn't say on the wing, but he said anywhere outside the square. And he didn't rule out him playing on a wing. They'll be looking for a wingman. And that's what they'll be looking for Jordan Clark to be.
I had a bit of a laugh this morning when news broke that the South Australian Workplace Safety Commission had cleared Adelaide of any wrongdoing in its pre-season camp. Now, we won't spend any time on this. I just wanted to say, well done. Only took you 3 years.
3 years? Talk about red tape.
And there's enough burnout from that camp to suggest that I don't know what they've missed here. But anyway, we move on from that.
I think when players – so when Indigenous players are going back to their tribal elders for reassurance – I think you've messed with their heads.
Yeah.
And I think that I don't care what WorkSafe says. You know, and everybody else knows, that you have stuffed up.
Mm. Despite the intentions being absolutely pure from Don Pike and the group, obviously they made a mistake in some people's eyes and some players' eyes, more importantly.
Well, and if Adelaide isn't prepared to acknowledge that, if they want to continue to go on in denial about this, they're not healing the wound that sits within their footy club. There are still people at that club who would have been severely distressed by what happened at that camp, and they would have either been distressed because of what happened to them, or distressed because of what they saw happen to their teammates and the effect it had on them. So, if you're Adelaide, you confirm that they've been cleared, but you should also be adding to that, we greatly regret the effect this has had on some of our players.
The other news, obviously, as we speak, it's evolving, is that the NRL is a cluster in Brisbane. So the NRL Grand Final slated for Sunday at Suncorp Stadium will be postponed or moved perhaps to Townsville. So I think the AFL will be looking across town and saying, wipe the forehead there. Thankfully, it's not us. But we feel for the NRL and hopefully they can resolve that.
Yep. Oh, well. Don't underestimate how close the AFL came. So the yes. AFL had contingency plans in place.
What were they?
I think it was playing the game later. So I think...
Later date?
Yeah, like putting it back 3 or 4 days. Like if we'd have gone into lockdown, say, on Thursday after the truckie thing, I think they were hoping we could come out on Monday or Tuesday and maybe play it on Wednesday.
There was a good banter in one of the functions I was at with the Premier speaking and Richard Goyder, who of course is the AFL chairman and also very high up at Qantas, the Premier saying, listen, just trying to check, Richard, you want the borders closed up until Saturday evening to make sure the grand final goes out. But say from Sunday, you'd like them open again so Qantas could operate for you. It was lovely banter between the two and it was taken in the right spirit, but there's certainly some politicising of the issue.
Well, I also liked that Gillon McLachlan saying he's going to build a wall.
Yeah.
It's going to be Eddie Maguire proof.
Yes.
And he's going to get the South Australians and Northern Territory to pay for it.
Exactly. I tell you what, he's a very good speaker, Gil, and he's got a great turn of phrase and sense of humour, and that was all.
Looked like he was enjoying himself over here, as you would, because you've obviously got some freedom of movement once you've quarantined, but he really did look like he was enjoying himself over here.
All right, let's move on to the juicy topic of the week, brought to you by Biggie Juice and Thirsty Camel Bottle Shops.
It was all a dream. Juicy topic of the week.
So in our paper today, an exclusive from John Townsend, the Waffle will revert to a 9-team competition next year after West Coast confirmed to the WA Football Commission that they would not enter a team in the league. Guys, where does this land?
It's really intriguing what they do. It looks like they'll be the sort of 8 to 12 players who are available but don't play in the ones will be at Perth and East Perth. It sounds like that's going to be the resolution next year. It's a bit messy. It's a bit untidy, but I'm not sure. Is the preference to go back to your original Waffle Club and share it around? Can that happen?
I'm just confused as to why the Eagles are heading down this track. Now, I know there were some complaints about the cost, and obviously it's an impost on your financial bottom line with regards to fielding a reserves team. But the finances obviously aren't an issue, I wouldn't have thought, for West Coast to keep this going. So
it was top-up player was tough too, weren't they, late in the year? I mean, they were 2 hours before a game late in the season, they were bringing in a player from the amateurs.
Yeah, I mean, so it was they weren't happy with some of the guidelines in place and all that, but I thought that might have been able to be worked through. I mean, from a traditional Waffle standpoint, it never really sat that well with me, having the Eagles in there. Didn't quite make sense. But again, I'm not quite sure what the Eagles' preference is moving forward.
To me, I think this is pretty simple if we apply common sense. And I hear what you're saying, Skeet, the Waffle traditionalists, but West Coast tip a lot of money into the WA football system. I think the WA football system needs to take a deep breath and step back and ask themselves, do we want our major provider operating at a competitive disadvantage? And to me, the Peel Thunder model has settled about where I think the rest of the competition is comfortable where it is. They loaded up Peel for a couple of years to win flags because they'd had the crap kicked out of them by the rest of the competition. Fremantle had the crap kicked out of them by everyone in Western Australian football. They all said, you know what, we've got a chance to win a flag. Let's win a couple here. Let's let's actually stick it up them a bit. And they loaded up and the competition didn't like it, and Subiaco, as strong as they are, weren't able to compete with Peel. We don't want that. But Peel since then has been somewhere between fourth and seventh on the ladder. They are not a laughing stock. They are able to compete strongly. They are not dominating the competition. So let's look at the Peel list and look at the demographic of that Peel list. Take out the AFL-listed players. Assume that the same number of, roughly, on average, the same number of West Coast-listed players will play as Fremantle-listed players play at Peel. And let's try and create that list for West Coast to have a team in the waffle. And I think it's not that hard. West Coast has the resources to do it and recruit people to do it. I think what they said when they brought him in is that they basically decided they weren't going to let him win.
And the Eagles, I think, without ever saying it to me, don't think they actually wanted to win a flag. They didn't want to finish last. I think they've always just wanted to be...
They want to compete.
Compete in the mix, playing finals perhaps, which they did. I mean, look, there is a... Yeah, I'm just confused as to what the next step is and why we couldn't have got to that point where the parties come together and find a resolution.
So with that, are we suggesting that perhaps next year we'll revert to this, maybe players at Perth, players at East Perth, while they draw a breath and see where they are the year after, which could be West Coast side again in the waffle competition?
See, again, I don't see – to me, that's rubbish. Perth is adamant it doesn't want to be an aligned club. But if you're getting six players every week from West Coast, you're half an aligned club.
Mm-hmm.
You're a little bit pregnant, aren't you?
Yes. So is the answer for a year at least going back to your original waffle club or being allotted draft, reverse draft order to a waffle club?
Well, I just
club?
Think the answer, and I'd be surprised if this is over. I think the answer is they sit down and they compare what West Coast has compared to what Peel has, and they say if Peel's about right and the competition's prepared to cop that, how do we create that for West Coast?
Now, by the way, the Peel model, is that sustainable and is it going to be going forward? Do Frio locked into that?
Well, they're...
Because you hear whispers that it's not.
You hear whispers about that. But, I mean, John Townsend's a great waffle reporter for us, but John's a very much a waffles traditionalist. He believes that they should just go back where the players are scattered to the four winds. There are two things about that I'll say. One is that every other club in the AFL has some form of reserves team.
Yes, they do.
So if our teams don't, to me, that looks a lot like competitive disadvantage. The other thing I would say is that one of the things our clubs have to be able to do is retain players. If a young player comes to Perth and then gets stuck at a waffle club where the waffle coach is telling him God knows what and is treating him God knows how, does that improve West Coast's chances of retaining him?
No, it doesn't. To me, it looks like we've been there a few times. And why are we back at this situation now?
It's a mess. Let's be honest. It's a bit of a mess at the moment with where we're at.
To me, Peel works. And Peel didn't work before Fremantle were aligned to them. Peel were winning one game in every six before Fremantle were aligned to them. Now, I'm not suggesting that Perth does that because Perth has a long history. I think if the commission stepped in and helped Perth, helped them to harness their talent demographic, because it's a difficult demographic to harness properly, I think Perth can climb the ladder and do something. But I read the story today and I thought if we're going back to that and the rest of the competition is moving in a completely different direction, I don't know. I shake my head at
that. I'm not sure how the Eagles can win out of this new setup if it is farming players out. The messaging, as we said, is going to be different. There's... Mm. Yeah, you're right. It's almost a step back in time and one that there's no way that it can be of benefit to the Eagles for what they're trying to achieve. It's quite simple. So this isn't a tactical move by the Eagles. They're genuinely saying, look, this won't work for us.
Well, I think they were worried about the money. And I interviewed Trevor Nisbet early in the season. Actually, it was after last season. And he talked about the cost of this. But I would have thought the cost of them doesn't have to be that much different to the cost of Fremantle of aligning with Peel. Because Fremantle pays for the coach at Peel and they'll pay for the next one as well. So I tend to think this is doable, and I tend to think the main thing is getting enough good players around West Coast's AFL-listed players so that they can compete. Not dominate, compete. I think they're allowed three marquee players the first year. So maybe the right number is five or six. Whatever it is, let's work to that figure and let's see if we can give them a team that finishes somewhere between fourth and seventh or eighth that isn't trailing off at the bottom end of the ladder, and is giving their players good match practice as they're trying to develop their way into the AFL system. I would argue that's more doable for West Coast than scattering their players to the four winds and hoping it works out okay.
Mm. And look, the other issue, which is not directly related to the Eagles, is unlike the AFL where the draft, the salary cap has, well, let's be honest, it's worked in giving Melbourne, the Bulldogs, Richmond, in terms of sharing the premierships around. That's what the AFL wants. Hasn't happened in the WAFL, no. Unfortunately. Subiaco, as good as they've been, and this is no knock on them. Congratulations, and they're in to another grand final, which I think they'll win. But then at the other end of the table, you've got Perth, East Fremantle, who, for whether it's their own fault or their zoning or what the issue is, they haven't been competitive in the last 20, 30 years. Now, the other issue that I look at is when I see the zones and see Claremont commentating a Colts game, have 60 players they use during the course of a season, and their bottom 20 are probably better than some of the others, say, at the Perth Footy Club in Colts. There is something not quite right. I know Russell Clark from the Demons has come together with, I think, at least one other CEO to point out to the WA Footy Commission that this has to be addressed. Now, that's not the be-all and end-all for success and not, but I think they regard that as critical to right the imbalance of access to players from Hale and Scotch and up north. And Claremont's, I think their Colts team very rarely misses the finals and very often plays in grand finals.
And, yeah, and they feed off the private schools. So they've got Scotch is right there, Christchurch is right there. So that's a big plus for them. The Subiaco situation, if you want to know why Subiaco is always at the top of the ladder, just open the bank accounts of the clubs and you'll see why. Look at their list. Where did Jordan Lockyer come from?
West Perth, wasn't he?
Yes. And there's about five players in that team that came from. Where did Brandon Matera come from? Wasn't Subiaco. You know, these are guys running around, and we've had, you know, before this year, we've had Litherland, we've had other players, you know. Litherland was coming back to Claremont. Claremont offered him X. Litherland told him they weren't even in the ballpark.
Mm.
And he was about Subiaco's seventh best player that year. Look at the bank balance and say, how do we fix this? Because the bank balance is the imbalance in the competition. Subiaco can do things, and it's not just about the players they can attract, and we have all sorts of jokes said about the white goods salary cap and all that sort of stuff, the contra ways they find to pay their players. It's also about the way they can resource their team and the way they can coach them and all those sorts of things, which is at a level over and above what the other teams can do. You know, my brother was at South Fremantle for a while as an assistant coach. He was one of Todd Curley's assistants and Paul Hazelby's assistant before then. And there was a lot of complaining at South Fremantle about, oh, you know, Peel this and Peel that. This is the era when Peel were loading up. And Brett made the point to a couple of people, we can't even beat Subi.
Mm.
You know, you guys are worried about Peel.
Mm.
But that'll come and go with different years, you know, when they can't load up there. Well, but we can't beat Subiaco. Ever.
Yeah. That's the issue in a broader sense of the competitive nature of the WAFL at the moment. I have to say, having called a lot of footy, the top end this year, very competitive. Claremont, South, West Perth and Subi thereabouts, Swans improving. But unfortunately, it fell away with Peel and West Coast, Perth and East Fremantle getting better. But you want to see, and this is not speaking as a demon support, you want to see a turnover of success, and that's
Perth,
what the competition
Perth
needs.
After breaking through for finals position the year before and then falling away again. So.
Yeah, but don't forget, Perth, so a lot of Subiaco players went, oh, nine-game season, we don't care. So they basically threw the year down the road, which is great for my club, South Fremantle. And, Skeet, I think you're allowed to talk as a Perth person on this. The plight of Perth in the waffle is unacceptable.
Mm.
We have to do something about it. They are responsible for the talent development pathway and the whole southeastern corridor there. That's too important a corridor to lose. So, therefore, Perth have to be better. And if they can't make themselves better, what did the AFL do with Melbourne? The AFL stepped in. They appointed their own CEO, basically, and they said, you know, we need to fix this because your club is going to die. So the West Australian Football Commission has to get more proactive, and they need to step in and they need to get involved, and they need to do something about Subiaco's dominance at one end, and they need to do something about the struggles at the other end.
And so the points situation which came into being, I think, a couple of years ago.
Which was completely manipulated by Subi, who were shifting players on and off their list mid-season to satisfy the points requirements. The points system had loopholes you could drive a truck through.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a good idea in theory, But let's make it stiff enough that, you know, the strong clubs can't manipulate it.
And we're still no closer to working out how this West Coast Eagles exit's going to benefit the Waffle or even the club itself.
Yes. Well, I think I'll be making a call to Trevor Nisbet this afternoon and seeing what he has to say. I'll be interested to see what their viewpoint is and where they view it as at, as being at. Anyway, we will move on. Let's get on to everybody's favourite segment.
Hello, Newman.
When you control the mail, you control information.
Josh's mailbag.
Congratulations on another season. And Skeet, thanks for joining us this year.
Been a pleasure. Yeah, mid-season draft or maybe just before that and hopefully get a new contract for 2022, but we'll wait and see.
I know it's a bit prickly always between you and I, but I'll just put that aside today, okay? And fantastic work at the North Melbourne lunch on Saturday.
Thank you very much. No, it's been a great week. And look, we're all looking for the finish line, but I tell you what.
Still one event to go tonight, mate.
Good tonight.
Sandover Medal.
Sandover Medal and the grand final on Saturday. Tonight. Yeah, but end of the day, we are lucky. We've been going to the football. We've been living a normal life, and we can never take that for granted given what's happening elsewhere.
Okay, let's move straight to the mailbag. We had a couple of people message me on my Instagram, which, okay, and just basically saying, will the podcast continue? It will.
Yes.
One day a week, especially through this trade period. It's actually one of our busiest traffic times at the West Australian with so much going around. Let's go straight to, I like this one, Nat Fife Leadership from Curtis Killian, Urban Grove. Hi, guys. What are your thoughts? Do you think Nat Fife has what it takes to lead the club into a sustained period of success like Gorn, pardon me, Koch and Hearn, Bontempelli, to name a few? For me, there just seems to be too many opinions from him about where he wants to play and not what's best for the team. Really hope I'm wrong on this, but just can't see him taking Freo to the next level. Cheers. What do you guys reckon?
I'm not sure has he been that opinionated about it? I think he's
been quieter this year, if anything.
Yeah, I think he's played where the team's wanted him to play. Am I wrong, Duff?
I think that sometimes the sins of the team get revisited on their best player. So we were saying Nathan Fife should go forward because they didn't have a forward. Then he went, he didn't play against Carlton in round three, and the midfield without Nathan Fife got absolutely brutalised. And then we said, oh, Nathan Fife has to come back into the middle. So I tend to think he's played where Justin Longmuir has wanted him to play. I think Justin Longmuir would want him to get forward a little bit more and kick some more goals. The problem is Nathan wasn't kicking goals. He was like, and Nathan's point, which was a self-deprecation more than anything, he made the point that, well, I am a very good inside mid and I haven't really proven myself to be a very good forward. So therefore, maybe I should play as a very good inside mid.
And off the back of that, have we seen, given age, injury, have we seen the best of Nat Fife?
I think Nathan Fife will still be a very good player and he's capable next year of being Fremantle's best player. But we went back and watched some footage of Nathan during the course of the year and it was from the 14-15 era and he's not anywhere near as dynamic an athlete in the wake of those two broken legs as he was back in those days. So he's powerful. He's hard to stop. He gets through an enormous amount of work in the midfield, but he is not the player he was.
Do you think he'll finish his career at Fremantle?
Yes.
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
No, I hope so, and I hope it's with some silverware. I really do. Nothing's guaranteed in life, but he would deserve some silverware. He's given a fair bit to
Right now, I'd take finals, let alone silverware.
No, he's been a super player. But you speak to footy people and someone suggested, look, was he tradable a year or two ago? He is the face of Fremantle in so many ways. Mm. But in terms of his age, what you get for him, it's only pub talk, but it's been interesting to hear Fremantle supporters talk on that level.
I reckon he was tradable 12 months ago, but I don't think he is now. Like, what's a club going to give up for Nathan Fife now? It's not worth Fremantle losing him. I think you're losing your captain. That damages your brand. Mm. 12 months ago, if you'd have got two top 10 draft picks for Nathan Fife, that's a trade worth doing, but not now. And my understanding is that the club had the discussion with him. It wasn't so much a proposal. It was basically, you know, do you want to be a one-club player? Because if you don't, if you're worried about it, then maybe this is our last chance to really cash in. And Nathan Fife's response was that he wanted to be a one-club player.
Let's go to Samuel Hocking. Hi, gents. Enjoy the show. Question, I noticed Duff interviewed Gil McLaughlin on the ABC. I was just wondering why he didn't ask him about the MCG contract. He was passionate about it the other day, and rightly so. Seemed a shame not to put it to him directly.
Yeah, fair call as well. Great correspondence there. And let's throw one at a little short pitch one at Duff as we roll through the mailbag.
Did we not ask Gil about the MCG contract on the radio?
I missed that one. Sorry, Duff.
I certainly asked, it was certainly put to him several times in interviews during the week, and it may have been that if it wasn't raised at on the radio, it was basically a case of we felt it had been bowled and played, if you like. His answer, I remember during the week, his answer was there is an MCG contract. Actually, no, I'm pretty sure the question was asked on Sports Talk when he was on Sports Talk. I might be wrong. I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure the question got asked. I think it got batted away.
Yeah, I think he's in general, he said it a few times this week, to be fair to Duff. It's been a case of, look, let's enjoy this game, let's enjoy the moment. But I think he was very cognizant of what Victorians are going through, having missed the past two grand finals. Let's not bring this into the forum at the moment. Let's have this game decided, and then maybe as we move on, the discussion will evolve.
I'm still confident that down the track – There's a possibility to revisit it in terms of perhaps every fifth year it's played somewhere outside Victoria.
And also, like the MCG was redeveloped when 1991 it went to Waverley. That type of event is now immoral to end up being a game in Sydney, Perth, Adelaide, wherever it is that's got the infrastructure in place.
They're missing a golden opportunity if they don't take one to Sydney. They really are. And not just from the exposure the game would get in Sydney and the boost that might give football in Sydney. Also, just from the point of view of stadium infrastructure in Sydney, the SCG is quite tired as a venue. You know, it still needs significant work, and it's a bit of a funky football venue anyway because it's shorter and wider than other venues. Homebush never really worked out.
It's like a ghost town out there. It's hard. So they need a new – I think they've been talking about the government there about building – a new stadium. That hasn't come to pass yet. So I think we're talking at least five or so years.
So we need, you know, for the AFL to get some sort of football input to that new stadium, for that new stadium to have an oval capability as opposed to a rectangular stadium that will shut footy out, I think footy needs to at least be open to the possibility of going to Sydney. And I think, Quarters, you said every 5 years. I would argue that every four is about right. And you know what I'm encouraged by? A number of the East Coast journos that came over were open to the idea.
Well, I think they are more so now, having seen their reaction to the event that we put on.
And also Gary Lyon, having spoken to him, Luke Hodge, and they didn't have to say what Duff said with regards to sharing the grand final, not every second year, but pick a time that works for certainly the national competition. They were open to the suggestion, primarily given that this was before the game. So afterwards, I think that would have been rubber stamped in their mind.
And we played a significant part here in triggering that discussion now, I think, down the track.
I asked Gil directly. I said, since Melbourne got the last 50, does that mean we get the next 50? He laughed
at me. Very good. Very nice video as well, Brownlee Medal. I loved it. It was worth watching and shows your versatility.
Thank you very much. Let's go to a classic one, Chera Talk. It's a bit of an essay and he's flagged that, Jake Jackson. But I'll just read the final line if we need clarity. He says, basically, people fall into two camps, basically saying that he's an amazing player, Chera, and we can't get rid of him. Or they're saying, get rid of him, he's not actually as good. He summarised it, Jake saying, why exactly is Chera rated so highly? As his stats, especially his disposal efficiency, isn't exactly mind-blowing and blowing anyone out of the water. Basically, is it all sizzle or is there some stake there as well?
What year is this? His third year, fourth year?
Fourth year. So and that bloke needs to stop looking at the statistics and watch the game.
Yeah, I think, and don't forget, he's still building. I think within a couple of years, he'll be one of the elite players in the comp.
I'm actually firing back at that bloke. Watch the game, mate.
Oh, he clarified, sorry, in his defence, he gave both options. He was literally just asking for your opinion.
Chera is an elite kick. Everyone knows he's an elite kick. Go and talk to the 18 coaches. They'll say Adam Chera is an elite kick. Champion Data, who's obviously sometimes watch games under the influence of mind-altering substances, have him listed as an average kick. He is not an average kick. He is an elite kick. Talk to anyone who knows their footy, they'll say Adam Chera is an elite kick. And there's too much bulldust that's born out of statistics. Stop playing fantasy footy. Watch the game.
Chris Petrarca 2 years ago or thereabouts, we were wondering, we're asking the question, we're not saying this is a correlation with the Chera discussion, but the growth of him in the past 12 months has been extraordinary. Adam Chera's got enough to suggest he can get, if not to that same level, certainly be a player of A-list quality.
I'm going to add Clayton Oliver to that as well. We were a couple of years ago saying he wastes his kicks and what have you. So, there's plenty of upside, and I think we've seen plenty of bloody good football from Chera too.
What? Adam Chera finished third in their best and fairest last year. I think the Doig medal count is on Saturday night. You'd expect him to finish. He missed a couple of games, so maybe top six, maybe top seven. Again, he's Fremantle, if you ask them to name their best five players, Adam Chera's in their best five players. And the reason he's in their best five players is because of the way he uses the ball. Go back to that moment in the Derby where he kicks the ball across his body and hits David Mundy, and then David Mundy kicks the ball across his body and hits Sean Darcy, and they get a goal out of it. That's Adam Chera's value to the team. Bloody statisticians. I mean, let's move on.
Michael Voss, should that happen, he ends up with a quality mid, very durable, I think played about 80 games, and just about to enter his prime. Again, he's in a pretty good position, Voss, if he can get that club, not just the squad, the club galvanised. That talk about
Nice 1-2 punch, isn't it, Walsh and Chera?
Mm.
Nice 1-2, that.
Let's go to John Stars. This is one from last week. Bit of an out there one, but I'm excited to hear your reaction. Hi, Josh and the Dynamic Trio. As I watched the prelim spiral out of control, I got thinking, how do you break momentum of play? As much as I enjoyed Ken Hinckley with his head in his hands and Chris Scott swearing at the glass, Simo's prognosis of the main issue this year that got away from them was the Eagles' inability to stop momentum. The answer, take something for basketball and allow the coach to call a snap 5-minute timeout per game. Before you scoff out loud, think about it. Coaches will love it for obvious reasons. Administrators will love it. We'll reduce the likelihood of blowouts and make games closer. Broadcasters will love it, obviously. Also adds another element of strategy. The third umpires get signaled from the coach and sends the message via the umpire's earpiece following the goal. All players on the bench gather around the coach and tactics tee up. It all happened in one day, and you heard it here first here on Duff and
Myers. I hate the idea.
No, I think, you know what? I think it's a great idea in a broad sense. It's not going to happen. He's trying to apply to other sports.
Interesting idea. I hate the
idea. Because momentum in footy is so massive.
We don't want any more stop-start.
No,
the
momentum in footy. On Sunday, watching the Waffle, it occurred to me, cheer, I reckon Todd Curley would like to call a timeout in the last quarter. And obviously, watching on Saturday night, you could tell if Bevo had a chance to pull the trigger with about 5 minutes to go before three-quarter time, he would have done it. But you're right. I think we're all agreed.
Why will we remember that game? We'll remember that game mainly for what happened in the second half of the third quarter.
Yep.
So why would you want to take that away from the game?
Yep.
I mean, one of the funniest things and one of the most memorable things I saw in footy in 2020 was when Carlton led West Coast by about 4 goals, and then West Coast stoppage crew got rolling and they went bang, 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 and towards the end of that run, Sam Doherty was perched on the back end of the centre square. So technically he was on the wing, satisfying the 6-6-6.
Yeah.
He wasn't even looking at the stoppage. He was like Usain Bolt in the starting position. And as soon as the ball was bounced, he was hooning into the defensive 50. It was, you know, great momentum is one of the great parts. Yeah,
and back in the day, you'd flood into your defensive 50, right? So, and it's ugly, and we wouldn't have seen the beauty of what we saw unfold late in the game. You're quite right, Duff. So, I think, you know, it's a very interesting idea, but not one that I like.
And the thing is, you're saying great for the broadcasters, but there were so many goals kicked on the weekend. The broadcasters were doing all right. There was a few ads getting run. Mm.
Absolutely. It's a few dollars a pop as well. Those 30 seconders came in gold.
This one's more to you guys after spending a couple of beers with Gil McLaughlin and interviewing him a couple of times, Duff. I don't know what you did, Skate, but
well, in general? I just know
you're emceeing every freaking event in Perth. So
hang on a sec. There's a bloke that's got me covered by some margin at the moment. Let's not go down that path.
I'm happy to go down if you want. But anyway, I was going to say, what's the plan for next year with the COVID protocols? Is Gil McLaughlin anticipating a year of it being open again, or what's he expected?
Well,
I know that, but speaking to him, like, does he expect an easier year next year or anything like that?
It's a hard question to answer. We don't know what's going on. I would assume that with the increase in vaccination rates, that borders will open. We've already seen the relaxing the situation in New South Wales. Eventually, the same thing will happen in Victoria. We have announced that we're going into lockdown. So our borders are slammed shut December, January. But we'll be revisited at a later date when we hit an unknown vaccination rate. What that is, I don't know. I would assume around about 80% of vaccination rates, we can start talking and we live with it.
So at our current rate of vaccination, Mark McGowan said at a press conference last week that we're at about 44% completely vaccinated.
Which is mm-hmm. pathetic.
And about 65, is it?
65-1.
Yep.
That's actually roughly in line with other states in Australia.
No, it's not. It's under. We are under. We're the worst state in Australia.
We're not that far behind. And the rate we're increasing at means that we will be at around 85% by December 31.
On that basis, and I'm speaking purely selfishly out of hoping to see my family, as you are, why then can't – I'm trying to go to Queensland, you're trying to go to Victoria.
We're going to have to – at some stage we are going to have to put on our big boys' pants and do that.
And if you're not vaccinated, then you miss out on some of these so-called privileges.
People who are able to be vaccinated.
And that's a vast majority, of the population.
They will be vaccinated when it –
And you also need to send the government a message. I mean, Mark McGowan has prosecuted a very clear plan and he's done it very well, and so we are able to do things that other states aren't able to do. I think we have significant geographical advantages that he maybe downplays a fair bit. But the big challenge for Mark McGowan is that when the others just vaccinate their way out of this and they say, okay, we're not going to do lockdowns anymore because you are going to go and get vaccinated. You should have been vaccinated by now. If you're not, then you're going to have to get vaccinated and hide until the vaccination kicks in, because basically we're not locking down anymore. That's going to be West Australia's challenge, because when the rest of Australia comes out of lockdown and we're still not letting them out, or letting them in and not letting families move freely backwards and forwards, then that is going to be politically challenging for him.
Well, what's going to be politically challenging is there'll be people in New South Wales who'll be able to fly overseas but not to Perth.
Yeah, and also sporting events next year. There's a very strong chance you'll have to be vaccinated to go to major concerts, major sporting events. Mm. And you know what? I never thought I'd see that in my lifetime, but guess what? That's what's going to get society moving forward. Embrace it, or we'll see you outside after the event.
Yep.
Yep. I agree. I think that's going to be Mark McGowan's big challenge. But I tend to think that I think we'll be more vaccinated than we think by the end of the
year. I hope you're right.
I think once that happens, there'll be a shift. Just don't know what the timing of that will be, but there's going to be a shift next season.
We'd like to know, as you said, from a WA perspective, what is that number? Is it 80? Is it 85? I mean, 90 is going to be tough to get to, given what the medicos are telling us publicly. So 80 plus surely gives us a chance to look at travel.
One of the very well-answered questions by Gil McLachlan during grand final week was, are you going to make it compulsory players vaccinated? And he said, look, our information is that the uptake's really strong and that we would like to get to a position where they're vaccinated anyway and we don't enforce it on them. So I think that's happening, and it will be very difficult for an unvaccinated player to be moving around Australia next year, I'd imagine.
So just to clarify the mechanics of those percentages I talked about, McGowan said that we're going up by about 0.5% a day, which means that by the end of October, we'll be over 60%. By the end of November, we'll be over 75%.
This is double vax?
Double vaxxed. Yep. And by the end of December, if the rate of vaccination continues, we'll be at 90%.
At the end of December?
At the end of December.
Well, I start to get a little bit more hope. And look, I'm saying that sincerely because I'm not the only one. There's so many people who haven't been able to come here or either leave and see loved ones. And the rest of it to go on holidays, you know, we'll work out other ways. But to see family, that is – and you've got a mate who's very unwell on the East Coast.
I do.
That is – that's what really gets to your heart.
And what I'm encouraged by is that, as well as Mark McGowan talking about hard borders and all those things, he also talks about we have to vaccinate. This is how we get out of this. So he is aware of that. How he manages that because of our hard borders is going to be interesting, but I tend to think we will get there.
Good. I hope you're right, Duff. I'd be delighted if that's the scenario.
Thank you very much for joining us today. We've been brought to you by TabTouch. You can get closer to the AFL action with TabTouch. Please gamble responsibly. Please call Gamblers Help on 1800 858 858 with any problems you encounter. We will be back next Tuesday. We're going to do it on Tuesday with a trade update, and we'll keep talking to you throughout the trade period.
If you're a fan of the podcast, why don't you send a message to Josh's mailbag? Have you figured out how to fix footy? Are you trying to settle a debate with a mate? Or maybe you just want two of Australia's most experienced footy journalists to turn their attention to an AFL issue of the week. Send to the mailbag at josh.garlep, that's G-A-R-L-E-P-P, at wanews.com.au. And also remember to like, subscribe, and of course, tell your mates so we can make this as big and as good as possible. Thanks for listening.
This has been the Duff and Quarters podcast on the game.
You know who? It's unbelievable.